Good evening and welcome once again to the Real Live Lesbian Show featuring Carmen Garcia and Rebecca Tron. Remember that world-famous lesbian mother's trial which took place in Dallas, Texas a couple of years ago? Well, on July 9th, I had the painful pleasure of interviewing Mary Jo Risher, the lesbian mother who was the defendant in that trial, and Anne Forman, the woman she lives with, about the trial itself and the new Doubleday publication about their case called By Her Own Admission, A Lesbian Mother's Fight to Keep Her Son. Before we begin the interview, however, here are a few announcements. The Bleecker Street Cinema is having what they allege to be a film festival on homosexuality every Tuesday evening, which started July 12th and is lasting through August 30th. I say purported to be because most of the films, of course, deal with gay men. However, there are a few about us as well. So for further information, please call the Bleecker Street Cinema, 144 Bleecker Street at LaGuardia Place in the Village. Telephone, area code 212-674-2560. Medusa's Revenge is presenting Bayou, a fantasy with music. Medusa's Revenge is located at 10 Bleecker Street at the Bowery. Performances are Thursday through Sunday at 8 p.m. And for further information and reservations, please call area code 212-532-4151. And this is for women. A Day for Women's Rights and a Call to Ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Saturday, August 27th, 1977. This day will include a march, which will assemble at Columbus Circle at noon for march up Broadway to Central Park, an ERA walkathon, a festival in Central Park's Bethesda Fountain at 72nd Street from 1 to 3 p.m., which will include games, zaps, speakers, such as Eleanor Smeal, president of NOW, and Betty Friedan, and others. For further information, please write to NOW, National Organization for Women, at 47 East 19th Street, New York, New York, 10003. And remember, a woman's place is open again, and there are a variety of July weekend workshops going on. We have some conflicting information as to what's happening this coming weekend, the 22nd through the 24th. One source says women and their bodies, the other says classism. Either will be interesting, no doubt. So for further information, please call area code 518. The number is 623-9541. And very apropos of this evening's show, Joan Larkin and Fran Wynant, both well-known lesbian feminist poets, will give a benefit poetry reading for the East Coast Lesbian Mothers Defense Fund, Monday, August 1st, 8 p.m., at St. Clement's Church, 423 West 46th Street. Okay, and now on to this evening's program.
Tell me again, Mommy. You and me against the world. Sometimes it feels like you and me against the world. When all the others turn their backs and walk away, you can count on me to stay. Remember when the circus came to town?
This is WBAI in New York City.
Sometimes it feels like you and me against the world. And for all the times we cried, I always felt that God was on our side. Then remember
I have in my hands a copy of By Her Own Admission. The subtitle is A Lesbian Mother's Fight to Keep Her Son. It's written by Gifford Guy Gibson with the collaboration of Mary Jo Risher, collaboration by experience. And sitting with me now, much to my delight, is Mary Jo Risher and Ann Forman.
Okay. It's good to be here, Rebecca.
Certainly, Rebecca.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay, and you've been in New York just since yesterday, as I understand?
Yes, and we'll be here for two more days.
Okay, and what are you doing while you're here?
Well, we're doing lots of things, lots of interviews, and we're promoting the book. We're doing television, radio, newspapers. You have it. We're doing it.
Mm-hmm. I have to warn the audience, as I warned you, that being a former Houstonian, I just know that my accent is going to come tumbling out, and by golly, you make me proud of it. So. Okay. I want to get right down to the basics.
Okay.
One thing that really bothered me when I was reading the book is that Mary Jo, your elder son, Jimmy, came across as a real culprit to me, a real traitor. Even though toward the end of this book and, you know, later on, you did apparently want to make peace with him when he was getting married at the age of 18, which I also thought was kind of strange under the circumstances. But he was the one who actually told his father about your relationship with Anne and that you were a lesbian in the first place, and later on actually was involved in testifying against you. Why did he do it?
Well, there was a combination of reasons, I think, Rebecca. The main reason was, and he related to me at a later time, he did receive an automobile from his father, an automobile that he had wanted, you know, had been after me for at least a year. Almost every day, as a teenager will, you know, they pick up on something and they have to, you know, remind you every day.
Especially there. You already bought him a motorcycle, right?
Well, I had already bought him one, yes, at the age of 15. So anyway, of course, shortly after he received the motorcycle, it was the car that he wanted at the age of 16. But Ann and I were not able financially to give this young man the car. We had other responsibilities, that mainly being of Richard. We found out that, you know, he had a slow reading problem. We had him to an ophthalmologist, and he had to have new glasses, and we obtained tutors for him for the summer of 74.
He was diagnosed so, dyslexic, is that correct?
No, he didn't have dyslexia, but the diagnostic test and everything showed that he, you know, was just a slow reader. So we felt like that to give him the security and the and you might say the will to just, you know, just go on, you know, in school, you might say, because a slow reader, you know, they feel like they're behind in all subjects, which they're, you know, which in a way they can really, you know, be if you don't catch something like that, especially reading, you know, when you find it out. And so we felt like that with the tutors and all, we could give him this confidence that he needed, and we did. And Jimmy just evidently couldn't relate to the fact that because, you know, as the book has shown, you know, I mean, you said you read it and all, Mr. Risher and I, even when we were married, tend to give Jimmy just about everything he wanted. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, I kept that up, I guess.
I'm just really struck at this moment more than ever with the irony of how, okay, you were unable financially to give Jimmy the car he wanted so badly, largely because of your great concern over your younger son Richard's reading problem, and that you wanted to use a lot of the money that you could have ordinarily used for the car on Richard for his welfare. And then it was Jimmy who, out of his 17-year-old, you know, who knows, competitiveness or that overwhelming desire for the car among his peers and himself and the whole thing, went to his father, and that's where the whole ball got started rolling, to take Richard away from you because you're supposedly an unfit mother. I mean, that's...
Well, that Jimmy said that that he, you know, he told his father of my homosexuality and that the car played a big part. Another thing that came into play was Jimmy also had a very sympathetic grandmother who, you know, knew of my homosexuality, and at a period of time during the past 3 years, you know, she was shocked when she heard it. She rejected me for 4 months. Mm-hmm. We did not have any communication with one another. And I feel like that, and Jimmy was living with her at the time. So I feel like that, you know, with her sort of rejecting me, it also built Jimmy, you know, in a sense, well, maybe, you know, my mother is. But the only thing is that Jimmy,
I knew of my homosexuality 4 months before Ann and I moved in together. Yeah. He became very friendly with Ann, became a friend to Ann, and encouraged the move, mm-hmm. you know, for us to begin a family unit.
And as I recall,
and he lived with us for 9 months. Okay, and not only that, but he brought, you know, girlfriends into the home for supper. He also brought girlfriends into the, you know, to attend dinner theaters with us, football games. The boys that he ran around with, he brought home to spend the night. And for 9 months, we enjoyed this this activity that this teenage boy, you know, enjoyed, and we became a very, you know, a part of it. At no time, and even under Jimmy's cross-examination on the stand, he was asked, did your mother ever indicate to any of your friends or anyone that you knew of that she was a homosexual? And he said, my mother never told anyone she was a homosexual. I told them she was a homosexual.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it was a combination of the car. He had a place, you know, his grandmother's home, and what have you, and of course he said he was embarrassed to the lifestyle, and he seemed not to be too embarrassed when he brought his friends all home.
Yeah, I'm very suspicious of Mr. Risher's motives also, in with this whole furor going on about a car. As I understand it, he actually gave the car to Jimmy on September 15th, 1974. And the temporary custody hearing occurred on October 15th, 1974. It's quite a coincidence.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, like I say, I mean, you know, I don't think any parent likes to think that a child possibly would take a material object, you know, or an item over the parent. But, you know, sometimes when a parent cannot give a child something they want so badly, they look for it, for, you know, from someone else, and Mr. Risher was able to give it to him, mm-hmm. and evidently for some exchange of information.
Mm. How is your relationship, both of you? Hello, Ann. I really know you're there. How is y'all's relationship now with Jimmy?
Well,
do you see him?
No, we don't see Jimmy at all now. As a matter of fact, he doesn't speak to any of the 70 members in Mary Jo's family, which I consider a rarity myself, because they were very close and clannish, her whole family is, and once you're a part of it, you're there to stay. I'm here to tell you that, because I've become a recent part of her family, so I feel very, very much a part of it and very close.
Speaking of which, happy anniversary. I think it was July 73.
And you're right. You're right.
Yeah,
yeah,
thank you. Yeah.
Really. Yes, yes. I met Anne July the 9th, 1973.
Oh, very close.
Thank
okay.
you very much,
yeah,
Rebecca. You have read the book.
Oh, absolutely.
But, no, I find it unusual that Jimmy hasn't even contacted his mother or his grandmother or his great-grandmother. He's now a father, and he has a small child. And nobody knows, you know, or seen the child or even knows the name except through Richard.
Well, who knows? I mean...
Well, he's got a long way to come. I think Mary Jo and I both realize that he's confused, and the amount of the publicity in the trial certainly was blown out of proportion for an average teenager to have to deal with. And we have our doors open to him when he wants to come, or if he wants to come back, and we're only as close as a phone, so all he has to do is pick up the phone and call, and we'll be there.
Right.
Then, too, I think possibly that that had the jury come in and had been in my favor, even a 9-3 would have left Richard within the home. I think this would have actually given to Jimmy what he really wanted, was someone to tell him and tell everybody, my mama's okay.
Yeah.
And when they came back with the decision to remove Richard from me, this was another thing that I think, you know, stood in Jimmy's way. Mm-hmm. Of, I'm not saying that he, you know, has rejected my lifestyle, because I really don't think that he had very close friends. Well, some of our close friends were very good to Jimmy, and there was a time when Jimmy wanted to go on vacation with two of our homosexual women friends, and, you know, and one of the women had three children, and Jimmy was invited to go to Mexico, and he wanted to go. And these people had been very good to him, and at one period of his time with us, he did make a comment that that our friends, the gay people, had been better to him than his own father. So, you know, what can you say? I saw a 17-year-old boy sit on the stand and use words that, like role models and things like this. Mm-hmm. And we do know that he had been in contact with the court-appointed psychologist and also had, at one period of time, been in the lawyer's office. So, and his testimony in the courtroom in 75 was not quite the his testimony in the temporary hearing in October 74.
Definite differences, yeah.
But, you know, what can you say there? I mean, if you tried to make a young man appear to be a liar on the stand, it's you're playing with fire because he could have come back and said, well, I lied in the temporary hearing, you know, and you don't want to destroy a child or a young person.
Right. And there'd been so much publicity in between, and I imagine so much pressure from all sides. You know?
Yeah, I'd like to point out a point, too. His mother didn't want him to be destroyed in the court on the stand either, and I think that's obviously, I would have done the same thing had it been my daughter, but there's a parallel here, and I think we can watch it. Of course, Judy Ann's just now 12, and she's going into adolescence. She's a little ahead of her time, I think, as usual. Judy Ann's always been that way.
Your daughter, Judy Ann.
Right, my daughter, Judy Ann, or our daughter, Judy Ann. Okay. But we can notice Judy Ann and the positive reinforcement she has from her father and how she's able to deal with us, even, you know, deal with our sexuality and the publicity, the enormous amount of publicity that's been around this case. And Jimmy was put in a situation, even before the publicity, where he did not have that positive reinforcement from his family. So at an age of confusion anyway, I think that it's you've got to give Jimmy his credit. He was not in the best situations as Judy Ann has been in the past, and I hope, and I'm sure will be in the future.
Judy Ann just sounds like a really fantastic, I even hesitate to call her child because she seems so incredibly mature and wise in some ways. At one point, I was reading about the trial, a psychiatrist who had interviewed her to ascertain her stability and all this stuff was saying that he had asked her, who do you get along with best? And she said, my mother. And he said, who do you get along with worst? And she said, my mother.
Right.
That's great.
All
right, remember.
She'll agree to that.
Well, so an unfit mother is one who wants to protect the son who, for one reason or many reasons, turned against her. Okay. Just want to have that little definition of what an unfit mother is. The irony is just scalding. I don't know what to say, really. Let me get back to a little bit more of the beginnings of this whole ordeal. In the pretrial custody hearing, this Judge Chrisman, I believe, had ruled that references to homosexuality could not be entered into the proceedings.
That's right.
And later on reversed his decision. Mm-hmm. Now, he knew that you were homosexual then, and he knew that you were living together then. What do you really believe made him change his mind?
Oh, I don't think there was any reason for him to take the stand he did in the beginning, nor reason for him to reverse it. The preliminary hearing was solely to ask the court to remove the children immediately from the home until we could get into the regular courtroom for the trial. And there was evidence brought into the courtroom that, you know, that the children were in no way in any harm. Mm-hmm. I might add that in that preliminary hearing, Jimmy had, you know, just about a month before that moved in with my mother. At that time, the judge ordered Jimmy back into our home, and he ordered the car back to the father. So I think that he viewed something there, you know. But, you know, when you're going into the courtroom, and, of course, you know, it was going to be a jury trial. It was, to our understanding, the first jury trial in the history of the United States to set in judgment on a homosexual parent to retain custody of their children or to regain, you know, or to gain custody of their children. And I feel like that at that time, Judge Chrisman, he knew, I felt like he knew that there would be innuendos, even, you know, I mean, that was a fear that I had anyway, as the book will state, one of my mad days, that innuendos would come into the courtroom anyway, and, you know, if indeed, you know, there was going to be any question of homosexuality, he would just let it all in, and it would be actually, I guess, up to the attorneys to either try to fool 12 people that I wasn't, or to go in as honest as we could be, show that the family was a working, viable family unit, stable, that every member loved one another, and go in being as honest as we could, rather than to try to, you know, let them think, well, something, you know, they're hearing one thing, but they know something else is going on, but they can't quite grasp what it is.
I think there was another element at work here, if I understand correctly, and that is that there's quite a question as to the constitutionality of allowing references to homosexuality to be made in such a situation, or allowing a mother to be declared unfit, as an unfit mother, simply because of her homosexuality, so that had homosexuality been kept out of the trial, homosexuality per se, or the direct reference to that, and the whole thing been conducted only on innuendo, you know, so you live with another woman, so you share a room, how cozy, I think it was, that in future trials, had there been appeals or whatever, people could have said, oh, what homosexuality? We never said it.
That's right.
Right, that's true.
Oh, that's true.
Also, I think the motion in limine was definitely an appeal tactic from our attorneys. They did that on purpose. That was one of the basic forms to have an appeals case. They were starting at the very bottom and working up because they certainly knew of the possibility that an appeal would be necessary. So they had to get that in. They had to start issuing their complaints and their opinions right there in the very beginning, and that's what they did.
On December 23rd, 1975, you got a terrific Christmas present when the foreman of the jury, who was one of the only two members who actually voted in your favor, did deliver the verdict that Richard was being taken away from you. How'd you feel at that moment?
Oh, goodness. I mean, you know, of course, when they read the verdict, you know, what words can I ever say as a mother, you know, as to what I felt at that moment? As though my life, that of 38 years, I'm past president of the Dallas County Council of Parent Teachers Association. I'm a life member of the Parent Teachers Association of the state of Texas. I am a belong to the Order of the Eastern Star. I've been a past Sunday school teacher for junior boys and girls in the Southern Baptist churches and assistant Sunday school teacher for adult women. And of course, that of, you know, being a mother for so many years. At that moment, in those few seconds, it was as if my life had been lived for nothing, as if the background that I had built, you know, had been for nothing. Preparing my children in the educational field, you know, in that if they needed tutors, they were there. Jimmy belonged to the band, and he had a beautiful saxophone that I went out and, you know, went in debt for.
While you were working and going to school.
Oh, yes, yes. And these things, you know, were provided for. They were like to the dentist every 6 months, to the doctor every 6 months for checkups and, you know, anything that had to be done as far as dental work and all was done. As, you know, and these people went on the stand, and as it was if, you know, they were saying to me, we have heard everybody that has told us about you, but it has meant nothing to us because, you know, you're worth nothing because of your homosexuality. And, you know, what can you say, you know, when you receive a verdict like that? Of course, you know, as time, you know, later on that afternoon, I did have an opportunity to find out, you know, what Tony Lucio said, and it made me feel, you know, somewhat better. I did, you know, I did watch the polling of the jurors. And at that time, I did know that he was one of the gentlemen that voted for me. Mm-hmm. And some of his comments were, you know, they felt like that some of the jurors, especially the women, felt like there should be roles in the family. There should be a man, you know, a husband and wife in the family. There was question as to whether two women could actually raise a child, you know, sufficiently. There was question... you know, as to whether Richard remaining in our home would, you know, would become a homosexual, even though one of the psychologists had already told the jurors, the juror in her evaluation of Richard, that he was male-orientated, that he wanted to be a policeman. He had already identified his sexuality.
And, of course, the whole point that most gay people actually grow up in heterosexual environments.
So. Yes. And, you know, and these things played, you know, I mean, these things he relayed to the press, which, of course, I was able to find out later in the day. He said, in essence, what this jury has done to Richard Calvin Risher is to take him from a good home and put him in what they consider a little better home. And, you know, to my understanding, it was to be, you know, that they were to prove my home, you know, unfit for Richard to remain there, and they never did.
No. As a matter of fact, and there was a lot of ugliness in the trial, a lot of extremely personal details were brought out on all sides. And I remember at one point your attorneys were bringing up some things about Mr. Risher's background, how he had allegedly, shall I say, fathered a child out of wedlock, how he had, I believe, been arrested for driving while intoxicated, if I'm not mistaken.
Paid for an abortion.
Yes, he had paid for an abortion.
I don't think he had, you know, I think what the thing was he had impregnated an 18-year-old girl, and he did testify that he did pay for the abortion. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that came out, and he did testify that he had been arrested for DWI.
And had been known to be violent on occasion with you.
Yes.
And
yes. Well, you know, there was one thing that they did ask Ann and I, too. And that was, you know, if, you know, of course I was on the stand first, they said, you know, would you give up your homosexuality if you were guaranteed to be able to keep your son? Do you know that in the history of this country and in the past, the present, and the future, I would like to see a heterosexual be asked that question. Would you give up your sexuality to keep your child? It will never be done.
Really?
You know? And yet, they could ask me to give up my sexuality, my sexual preference, you know. Would you give it up to keep your child? Now, what do you say?
I think someone commented then that the state of Texas, wouldn't you know it, the state of Texas can ask you to give up your sexuality, what they want you to do, become a eunuch or something.
Right,
like
correct. You know, that's what I was going to say. They also made a big play on the fact that this was a social experiment to leave Richard in their home. And with the divorce rate at 51% in Dallas, Texas alone, I wonder how many heterosexual homes social experiments are being conducted. Mm. Obviously, this wasn't any more a social experiment than what all these heterosexual families have done with the children.
I want to ask some questions now. You are of Southern Baptist background, Mary Jo. Are you also
I was raised in a Southern Baptist family, yes.
Okay. And do you now have any affiliations with Metropolitan Community Church or any sort of a religious organization in Dallas?
Well, Ann and I attend you know, a Methodist church every once in a while. Of course, the Southern Baptist, you know, church that I'm a member of hasn't sent me any note or anything or a letter lately saying, you know, we miss you.
Right.
You know, you know, why don't you come back if we've done anything wrong to you or something like that. Like, usually they will do, you know, if they miss a member of their congregation, they will, you know, either by letter or by telephone, wonder why you're not attending. And I have never received any such communication from my church, and I really don't expect to.
We do go to MCC on occasion to visit. We enjoy that also.
A part of the book really struck me where a lot of Baptist ministers and chaplains were brought before the jury and those who were watching. And I've got some notes here, and I'm going to go ahead and delve into them for a moment. Got a kick out of when Dr. Philip Smith of the Lakeland Baptist Church in Louisville, is it Louisville, Texas, as opposed to Louisville, was a witness against you. And he started citing all sorts of anti-homosexual biblical references. And then your lawyer, Mr. Stenger, I believe, led this minister to state how, according to his interpretation, his very literal interpretation of the Bible, it was also prohibited to smoke, to drink. Abortion was certainly prohibited. Oral sex, even between a man and a wife, was prohibited. Dancing can lead to immorality and all that sort of thing. And later on, Reverend Waits, I believe who's the chaplain at the hospital at which you worked, Mary Jo, is that correct?
Yes, right.
Seemed to be a very favorable witness. And was on the stand and talking about your stability and your good character and the suitability of your home, both of you, the home of both of you, for raising children. And then the other lawyer, Mike McCurley, I don't know, but I really don't want to meet him. I don't like him. Tried to lead Reverend Waits into sort of a literal interpretation of the Bible. And Waits stated that he was not a fundamentalist, and he maintained that times and contexts change, and that according to the Bible, women who give birth are also supposed to sacrifice two ewe lambs or two doves, which I thought was really a terrific thing for him to bring up. Also the fact that another interesting thing in the book was that Texas law states that children must be raised in a religious home.
Yes, that's Rebecca, I have a feeling that that portion, it's a new family code in the in fact it was just adopted 2 years ago in the state of Texas, just before we went into court. And I have a feeling that before too long, that section of the family code will be challenged by someone.
Well, we're bringing that up on appeal too. That's part of our case, but also the fact that in the Dallas area and in Texas area, since we are in the Bible Belt and primarily the people are Baptists, your religious home would have to be your Baptist. So that leaves just a whole bunch of people out.
Boy,
of course,
your
atheists and ethical groups don't have a chance, and you're Jewish, and you can go on and on and on to the Catholic, and even some of the other Protestant religions would just be left out in left field.
And you know what about the separation of church and state anyway?
Oh, that's true.
Yes, that's right. Obviously there's a lot of amendments that weren't upheld in this court case.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, they certainly sound clear cut enough.
Oh yes.